Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Lee Catherine Goldstein, bar number 31548, and I'm here today representing the appellants, Capital Value and David Tolson. This case rises on appeal from a series of three orders granting summary judgment in favor of the defendants on the sole basis that the plaintiff lacked a real estate license and a securities license. Those orders were error and must be reversed for three reasons. First, the work for which the plaintiffs sought recovery in this case did not require a real estate license or a securities license. Second, it does not violate public policy to allow a party to recover for services which do not require a license. And third, Colorado law in fact requires that the contract be severed and that recovery be allowed in the circumstances presented in this case.
What about federal law and the securities? Does the case law also require that it be severed in this case?
You know, the only federal case that I found that concerns severance at all is the unpublished opinion that I cited in the brief. I believe it's called Diversified, and it allowed severance. It didn't really discuss severance, but it allowed severance. You know, the important thing to keep in mind about the federal securities laws is that the federal courts do not interpret that statute as voiding the contracts. They interpret it as setting up an affirmative defense that the contract is voidable. And then they look at the voidability of the contract in terms of whether the party seeking to void the contract comes to the court with clean hands and whether the contract has been fully performed. And I cited several of those cases in my brief. I think they're probably in the reply brief that discuss how the federal courts deal with this issue.
If we interpret that use of the word void in the federal statutes differently from the federal cases, are we bound by those decisions?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, typically we aren't bound by the lower federal court's cases. Now, I do understand that they're interpreting a federal statute, and I'm wondering what the binding effect might be if we were to disagree. The statute uses the word void,
mm-hmm.
and I understand that there's federal case law that says that void means voidable in that instance.
Correct.
But are we required to follow those cases if we think void means void in that statute?
I'm not sure I know the answer to your question, Your Honor. Those cases basically, you know, deal with the ramifications of the statute, and they say that, you know, under the circumstances that are presented in these security situations, we don't void the contract, especially when you have the party seeking to void the contract comes to the court with unclean hands, and that's certainly the case here. Returning to Colorado law, you know, the Colorado law is clear and was established by the court back in 1956, I believe, in the case of Carter versus Thompson. And in Carter versus Thompson, the Supreme Court held that where a contract covers both services for which a license is required and services for which a license is not required, then the part of the contract covering services for which a license is not required must be upheld if the contract is severable. In this case, the trial court did not follow Carter at all. Instead, it followed the reasoning in Brokaw. That's what the trial judge said. He said that under Brokaw, public policy prevented him from severing the contract. And that is wrong under the Carter case, which was recently reaffirmed by the Supreme Court, that Carter rule, in the case of City of Aurora versus Colorado State Engineer. So basically, Brokaw, the thing that you have to keep in mind about Brokaw, is that it does not stand for the proposition that any contract which part of the services under it would violate the real estate licensing laws is automatically void and not subject to be severed. In fact, it's completely consistent with the Carter rule. Brokaw is very factually in one particular paradigm, which isn't the paradigm we have here. In Brokaw, the transaction for which the person, Mr. Brokaw, sought to be paid was itself, that transaction was a violation of the real estate law. So what he said was, never mind all that, basically discount my fee. So the severance that he was trying to do in that decision was to sever the fee that he was going to receive for a transaction that violated the law. In this case, that's not what we're asking for at all. It's important and critical, in fact, to keep in mind that the transaction for which the plaintiff sought to recover was help in obtaining a loan to U.S. Bank, that a loan from U.S. Bank, I'm sorry, and that transaction itself never violated the securities laws and it never violated the real estate laws. And there was no showing by the defendant that it did. They kept harping on a different part of transactions involving, you know, equity sales. That's not what the plaintiff was seeking to recover for in this case.
Yeah. Counsel, I understand the distinction that you're making about this case and Brokaw, but I guess I'm asking, if we sever these sorts of contracts that have clearly illegal provisions, mm-hmm. isn't that just encouraging the illegal activity? Isn't a better choice of public policy to just say that the contract fails?
No, Your Honor, because if you say that, you've created an unjust situation where people cannot recover for lawful services. That's point one. Point two is the Colorado Supreme Court has already made that policy decision. They made that policy decision back in 1956 when they decided the Carter case.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt. What about the absence of a severability clause in the contract itself?
It's not determinative, Your Honor. Because the Colorado law on severability has you look at several circumstances. It doesn't say look to the contract and if there's no severability clause, then boom, you know, the contract is not severable. In fact, it's much more extensive than that. And it's laid out in the John versus United Advertising case. And what it says is you look to the terms of the contract itself and you look to the way that the parties performed the contract to determine whether it's severable. And when you look at both of those factors in this case, you can only reach the conclusion that the contract is severable.
So is it your assertion that the contract is severable as a matter of law, or just that, gee, the severability of the contract ought to be returned to be determined as a question of fact and law by the trial court, as opposed to resolved in a summary judgment motion?
Well, Your Honor, we're asking that the court rule, as the court did in Carter, that the contract is severable as a matter of law.
Isn't it still, whether or not it's, if it's not severable as a matter of law, it's kind of what the trial court ruled, but isn't it still a matter of the intent of the parties as to whether they intended to severance, and did the trial court make any findings on that issue?
Your Honor, we don't believe the trial court did make findings on that issue. What the trial court said was, it did put one sentence in there that said there's no severability provision, but then what the trial court said was, following the Brokaw court's reasoning, this court finds that allowing the contract to be severed would emasculate the purpose of the statute.
Okay, so in Carter, where you're saying that they said it was severable as a matter of law, or was that like this case where there had been no findings about the intent of the parties, or was there some clear evidence of the party's intent that the contract be severable?
I don't believe the court in Carter actually discussed the intent of the parties. What it did was it discussed what the contract was, and the contract was for installation of furnace and attendant pieces and installation of plumbing. And so what the trial court had done was it granted summary judgment because the person in Carter, Mr. Carter, was not a plumber. And then the Supreme Court reversed and it said, well, wait a second, you don't need to be a plumber to install a furnace. So it remanded back down with instructions that the contract was severable and that the plaintiff could recover for the furnace installation services under the contract. And it said, to do otherwise would do violence to the law, would create an unjust result. And that's what we are looking at in this case under the trial court's ruling, a very unjust result. Going back to the evidence on severance, I want to talk just a second about the contract itself. So the contract terms themselves show that the parties intended it to be severed. I mean, first, you've got the contract calling for different types of services. There are services for assistance in selling all or part of the company. Then there are services for assistance in obtaining a loan. The contract also has different fees for these different types of services. If the services for selling part of the company would be a 4.5% fee, selling all of the company would be a 4% fee, and getting a loan for the company, as happened in this case, is a 4.5% fee. So you have the different services, the different fees for those services.
Even if the structure of the contract implies that the parties intended for it to be severable, as an appellate court, can we make that finding a fact, or is that something that the trial court would need to do?
Well, Your Honor, the court did in Carter, looked at the contract there and found that based on the way it was set up, it was severable. So if this court feels that there are facts that need to be found, obviously it does need to go back to the trial court for those findings. But we believe that the record is clear on the summary judgment that the contract is severable as a matter of law in this case. You know, the second part concerns the performance of the parties under the contract. And it's important to note here that the contract was actually performed at different times, these different services. So from and after December of 2009, the only services that were performed by Capital Value under the contract were geared towards obtaining a loan. Therefore, the actual performance by the parties severed the performance under the contract. Your Honor, I see that I have about 4.5 minutes left, and I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, Daryl Bailey on behalf of the appellees, K2D Inc., Don Babcock, Kevin LaFleur, and Triton Capital. The issue raised by Capital Value today is whether the contract at issue here is severable. They seek a ruling that it is severable as a matter of law. And were we here in 1963, they actually may have a good argument. In 1963, the Supreme Court actually ruled in Carey v. Borden that a business broker, such as Capital Value, in that case it was Carey, who sought a fee for sale of a business that included real estate, the Supreme Court held that that broker could in fact recover a fee even though he was not licensed as a real estate broker. That case was in 1963. That case is very similar to the Carter v. Tompkins case from 1956, where the court also allowed some severance of the contract and some recovery of a fee. But the dispute that we have today is really whether Broholm, the Supreme Court case, is controlling or Carter v. Tompkins is controlling. And I would contend that, as noted in Broholm, when the state legislature in 1965 changed the real estate statute in direct response to the Carey v. Borden case, that the Carter v. Tompkins logic no longer applied to the real estate statute. And if you look, if you start the analysis with the Carey v. Borden case, they actually looked at the state of the law in 1963, and they said, okay, we've got a guy who sold a company, he's got some real estate. Should we give him a fee or not? And they said there are three specific trends in the law right now. There's the New York rule, which says that it doesn't matter if part of it's real estate, if it's, as long as it's not dominant, we'll give him a fee. There was a New Jersey rule that said if real estate is part of it and you're not licensed, you don't get a fee. And then there was a California case that said we'll give a fee for the part that's real estate and, excuse me, the part that's not real estate and deprive it for the part that's real estate. Again, as noted in Broholm, 1965, the legislature expressly said, we do not like the fact that the Colorado Supreme Court adopted the New York rule. We think the New Jersey rule, which precludes a fee in its entirety, is the appropriate rule in this state.
Do you disagree that there's a distinction between this case and Broholm, in that in Broholm they were trying to apportion a fee, whereas in this case they're trying to basically apportion different actions that were contracted for?
I think it becomes a matter of semantics, and I think it's a matter of public policy that we shouldn't allow the semantics to determine whether someone gets a fee or not. And I say it's semantics because in Broholm you can phrase it one of two ways. You can state, I sold a company and I'm seeking a fee for only those portions that were personal property and didn't require a real estate license. That's the apportionment argument. You could just as easily make the contention that what Broholm was saying is, I did two things. I sold real estate and I sold personal property. And that's essentially what Capital Value is doing, saying we did this and we did this.
Well, the contract was set up though with different commission rates for different activities. So that's a little bit different, I'm thinking, than the situation in Broholm.
It is unfair for me in Broholm. I think there was only one commission rate, if I recall correctly. And you're correct that here the contract does have two different commission rates. But when read as a whole, in the absence of the severability clause, I think as a matter of public policy, you should not allow financial professionals to come in and argue that they should be entitled to a fee for services which don't require licensure when they've admitted that they didn't have the licenses that they required to perform the majority of the contract. And I think that it should be a bright line rule as a matter of policy. And if you look at the reason for both the securities licensure statute and the real estate licensure statute, it's to protect the public from financial professionals to whom they are entrusting pretty significant life decisions.
Does the record reflect whether the lack of licensure was known to your client?
The agreement itself states that Capital Value did not have a securities license. It is silent as to real estate broker's license.
And isn't there a question of fact as to whether they needed a securities license?
I don't believe that there is. I think the facts are undisputed as to that.
Wasn't there an expert opinion that was offered through former Director Fagan that indicated that it would not have required a securities license to have engaged in that activity?
The activity that he opined he did not need a license for was the activity of placing a loan, of loan servicing. It was not the securities. I think it is beyond dispute that they offered securities for sale, that securities were not registered, and they did not have a license at the time. And back to the point that the contract actually did disclose that under the Federal Securities Act 29A, it provides that if you have a clause in a contract that attempts to get around a securities licensing requirement, that clause itself is void.
But wouldn't your client have known that the securities were unregistered? I mean, they were their securities, right?
That is correct. I would believe they would know they were unregistered. I do not believe they would know that there was a requirement for registration. And I think in circumstances where you have financial professionals providing services to consumers, that the onus should be on the financial professional to be clear on what services they're providing and to ensure that they have the license required to perform those services. That's the policy which is evidenced by the Colorado Consumer Protection Act, which actually has a specific deceptive trade practice where you offer services for which you're not licensed. And it appears to be the policy which is set forth in Broval that you want to protect the consumers. I mean, there is a way in which a financial professional could get around this by clearly stating, I am going to be selling your company, includes assets, which includes real estate, and I have a license, or, and I have a relationship with a real estate broker who is licensed.
Right, but here they're not getting paid for any activities that required a license, right?
That is correct. And okay. I think that is very similar to every other case that I have seen that's come up to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. Every party, whether it's in Leaf or Amadeus or Brockage, all of those, the party who is seeking a fee comes to the court and tries to parse the statute, tries to split hairs, tries to say the services that I performed are not within the statute. Some of them might have been, but the ones I performed were not. And in every case, the person seeking the fee has been rebuked and has said, no, part of the services that you perform, no matter how you split it, how you define it, were within the statute, and we're not going, as a matter of public policy, to allow you to recover a fee. And Capital Value's attempts here are just like that. It is an attempt to parse the statute and split hairs. And again, I think a bright line rule that says if part of your services that you're performing require a license, whether it's securities license or a real estate broker's license, if your services perform a license and you don't have that, then the contract upon which you are seeking to recover cannot be enforced.
What would happen if you had asked or if they had agreed to perform 8 or 10 different types of services, but only one would have required a license? Would you still be here arguing that kind of like, nope, we don't have to pay for any of the other 7 or 8 types of services that were provided to us? Would you still be here arguing that?
I have two answers, and my answer is this. Broval, in that case, Mr. Broholt said the real estate component was de minimis. It was just 5% of the purchase price. So 95% of what I'm doing doesn't require a license. You should give me that percentage of the fee. Now, whether you look at that as one task or 10 different things he's doing, the Supreme Court said, no, if it's part of what you're doing requires licensure, then you're not going to get a fee.
So your answer is you would be here arguing that?
I would be, although, I mean, I will
And let me ask you this, isn't there also a public policy that supports basically people honoring their agreements?
There is, and I think that there is, I can actually see an instance in which I would not be arguing that the 1 or 10, I'll tell you what that is candidly. If, as I said, I think it should be incumbent upon the financial professional to be clear with the consumers what it is that they are providing, what services require license and what don't. And so if you had a contract that said, "Dear Mr. Consumer, I, financial professional, am going to do the following three things for you. One, offer to sell your stock. I'm a licensed securities broker and I'm going to sell the stock of your company. Two, I'm going to, as part of that, your real estate will be sold and I am a licensed real estate broker and will offer to do that. And three, in the event I fail, I will then go try to get other financing for you." If it's very clear, then in that situation, I think it becomes more like a, well, you can see, and there's different fees for those. You can see where those could be three distinct acts. But the onus for that clarity should be on the financial professional. We don't have that here. You can read the first paragraph of the agreement between the parties here, and it says, Dear Colorado Premium, thank you for retaining us to sell your business. We enjoy representing quality businesses for sale. We will find people, here and after buyers, to help you, sellers, in the sale of your company. We do more than ordinary business brokers. And then they have this string of words that says, we will find people to invest in, lease to, loan to, buy, purchase, or otherwise acquire an interest in. So they string all these words together to try to grab their fee.
Okay. I'm sorry for interrupting, counsel. Because this is a summary judgment, we don't really know what conversations the parties had outside the fair contract. So if perchance they had made their licensure and their services clear, but had just not put it in the written agreement, wouldn't we be in the hypothetical that you were offering?
I don't think that's correct.
So you're saying it has to be part of the written agreement in this situation?
Well, I was answering the justice's question about, is there a situation I can see in which there might be a different rule? And
right.
I can see that candidly.
And I guess, but I'm saying, how do we know we're not in that situation? Because all we're in summary judgment, and we're basically looking primarily at the written documents.
Well, I would go back to the public policy that says that if you are within the statute that requires you the securities broker license or real estate broker license, and you don't have that, then you have an entire contract, then you cannot sever and try to split hairs in order to recover your fee. I think it's a matter of public policy, you can't. And I would, if I can turn for a moment to the state securities law issue as well, which we have cited in our brief, CRS 11-51-60410. Now, the federal securities law states that a contract in violation of the securities law is void. We do not have that same language in the state statute, and there's actually no cases that I've found that are actually reported under this statute. But what the state statute says is that if you're a person who makes or engages in performance of a contract in violation of the state securities laws, then you cannot base any suit on the contract. And I think that last language is very important. It doesn't say the contract's void, it says you may not base any suit on the contract. If the state legislature wanted to allow a party who was an unlicensed securities broker to file a claim based upon a contract that was in violation of the securities law and recover for other services, that statute could read, you can't base any suit on the provisions of the contract which are in violation of the securities laws. It doesn't say that. It says you can't base any suit on the contract. So we have a contract here which the trial court has found, Capital Value has admitted, was in violation of the securities laws because they offered to sell unregistered stock. It's in violation of the state securities laws, and yet they are seeking to base a suit on that contract, claiming services for things that they claim are outside of the scope of the securities and real estate statute. And I think based on the state securities law statute alone, that the trial court's order should be affirmed. In each of the cases that I've mentioned, like the Bocage, Leif, Amadeus, each of those, the party who came before the court tried to characterize their conduct as being outside of the real estate statute and tried to get a fee. But Amadeus is particularly interesting because in that case, the contract provided that the party who was the business broker was going to find people who would provide an investment in or other financial involvement to a real estate project. Those are very broad words. Those could easily include a loan, something which capital value claims doesn't require a license. If you're trying to find investment in or financial involvement in a real estate project, it could just be getting a loan for that project. Yet nonetheless, the panel in that case indicated that because the services that were being performed, at least some of them were within the real estate statute, that contract was in violation of the statute and was void. And I would contend that this contract here, which has similar language, will get investors and purchasers and people to lease or acquire an interest in or loan to, that string of words, which is most of which was inside the real estate statute, is enough to void the contract here and provide no recovery whatsoever.
And counsel, I see you're out of time.
Yeah.
Red light is on. Thank you very much for your argument. Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you.
Could you start out by addressing the state securities law statute that counsel was talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. The state security statute, I don't recall the exact terms of it, but I do recall similarly saying that a suit based on a contract, that you can't base a suit on a contract that violates the securities laws. But what it doesn't say is that you can't sever the contract and base a suit on a contract that does not violate the securities laws that is contained or coupled with a contract that does. And that's really the important piece here.
Let me ask you, doesn't any suit on the contract, doesn't that suggest all, any imaginable suit you can come up with on the contract?
You know, to me, it suggests the different types of claims that one might bring. So you might bring a breach of good faith, fair dealing, a breach of contract suit, an unjust enrichment suit on the contract that involves the purchase and sale of securities. This part of the contract that we're talking about does not involve the purchase and sale of securities. What it involves is assistance in procuring a loan, and that's what Mr. Fegan had opined does not violate the securities laws.
Right. This part of the contract, you know, would not have violated the securities
law. Exactly.
But another part of the contract would have violated the securities laws, and under the at least literal language of that provision, doesn't that suggest that you can't bring any suit for any relief on the contract that would contain provisions violating the securities law?
Well, it does not say that you can't, that the doctrine of severability, which has been a part of Colorado law since at least the 1950s and probably before that, is abrogated with respect to any contract that implicates the securities laws.
Well, couldn't that statute be viewed as encompassing a public policy choice of non-severability when it contains a securities law violation?
You'd have to imply that, Your Honor. That's not what the law says. I mean, the legislature certainly would know how to say, and you can't apply the doctrine of severability if that was their intention.
Have they said that in other cases involving other contracts? Has the legislature been that explicit about other types of contracts? You can't have severability clauses?
I haven't seen that, Your Honor, but that's partially because the doctrine of severability applies in Colorado. You know, we have that Carter versus Thompson case by the Supreme Court way back in the 50s. It was recently affirmed by the Colorado Supreme Court in the case of City of Aurora versus Colorado Engineer. And all of these are licensure. You know, those are both cases involving a licensed professional. And the Colorado Supreme Court said, hey, we're going to apply the doctrine of severability and allow those people to recover for the services that did not require licensure. You know, it's the same with the real estate statute. The real estate statute does not seek to abrogate the doctrine of severability. And there are other state cases, other states' cases, I should say, that I've cited in the opening brief that talk about the same concept under their laws. And they do the same type of analysis, and they look at it and they say, is there anything about our state's licensing law that abrogates the doctrine of severability? No, there's not. The doctrine of severability applies, and you allow that person to recover for the services that did not require a license. Why do you do that? Because to do otherwise is unjust. It allows a party like the appellees here to get something for nothing.
Counsel, let me ask you, opposing counsel cited the first paragraph of the contract. Why would that not at least create an issue of fact as to what the predominant purpose of that contract was, sales or loans? And as the predominant purpose as to whether or not it could be severed?
I guess the simplest answer is, I'm not sure that severance depends on the predominant purpose of the contract. The severance depends on all of the terms of the contract and the conduct of the parties. So, it's fairly disingenuous for the appellees to claim that the contract did not cover loan services. In December of 2009, the appellees directed Capital Value to focus all of its efforts on obtaining a loan for Colorado Premium. And there were a series of emails that are attached to the response to the motion for summary judgment. They were authenticated by an affidavit that show all of the dealings between the parties from December of 2009 through June 2010 are based solely on obtaining a loan.
Okay. Counsel, I see your time has expired. Thank you very much for your
argument.
Judge, may I ask one question?
Yeah.
How would you distinguish the language in the Amadeus contract from your contract?
I don't recall the language of the Amadeus contract off the top of my head. My recollection is that Amadeus, just like all of these other cases that the appellee has cited, dealt with a transaction that itself was a violation of the real estate law or the securities laws. I do recall Amadeus. What Amadeus was saying was that the service for which the person in that case was seeking to recover actually wasn't covered under the contract. And what they were saying was, well, this was part and parcel of the work we were doing for them. And the court in Amadeus basically said, look, it's derivative of the contract. So any right that they had at all to recover for the faucets, I think it was, or water rights, was entirely derivative of the contract. It wasn't spelled out. Here, we have a completely different circumstance. We have the loan services were spelled out under the contract.
Okay. Thank you very much. Does that satisfy you?
It does.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel, for both of your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.